United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Beverly Martin. We are glad to be with you today and appreciate your adaptability in appearing by telephone. Judge Newsom and I have been delighted this week to sit with Judge Baldock, who sits in the 10th Circuit. Judge Baldock is a friend to the circuit and a friend to me, and I always enjoy being with him. I'm just sorry it couldn't be in person, Judge Baldock. He gets extra credit this morning because it's just about to turn 7 a.m. where he is, so we appreciate you getting up early this morning, Judge Baldock.
Thank you, Judge.
For counsel, I've asked Ms. Tisa to let you know when you're 2 minutes from the end of your argument time, and she will repeat it twice because sometimes it's hard to hear the first time, and she'll also let you know when your time has expired. In our instructions to you, we would give you 2 minutes of uninterrupted argument to begin. With that, I think we're ready to get underway with the United States of America versus Corey Pearson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Anna Davidi. I am the attorney for appellant Corey Pearson. May I proceed?
You may. Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning. Today I will be concentrating on issue one of my brief. That issue distinctly deals with the court's failure to grant a motion for mistrial after a 22-day hiatus or separation of jury because of a natural disaster, therefore denying my client his due process rights. I'd like to advise the court first and foremost that this is a case of first impression in this circuit. I want to take about a moment to just go over very quickly the chronological order of the things that happened in this case, because I think that is very important. This case began, and after 4 days of trial on September 6th, in anticipation of the impending Hurricane Irene, the defense attorney, in conjunction with the government, both requested that the court jointly recess the trial for that day due to the impending hurricane and the problems with travel and the lack of gas and the preparation of their home. Hurricane Irma did hit South Florida as it continued up the Northeast, further hitting New York and New Jersey. There was catastrophic injury. There was death. There was lack of electricity to more than 70% of the homes. On September 13th, the defense attorney, Mr. Stein, quite diligently wrote an email to the court administrator advising, updating of his situation and advising of the court that there was substantial damage to his home and that he had some sort of limited availability at that point. It is important to note that during this time, the court is closed, Dade County Public Schools are closed, the court is open according to the schedule of Dade County Schools. The society or the community at large is dealing with the impact of this hurricane. On September 15th, 2 days later, without any further correspondence to any of the attorneys, the circuit court judge recessed the trial through September 25th. The district court judge convened the trial on September 25th. At this point, 19 days had passed, and the hurricane, while it had already passed, there were still devastating effects from it. On September 25th, the lawyers went into trial, and there were two jurors from the panel that had left the country. At this time, the court discussed the lack of these two jurors and gave the attorneys an option to proceed. At that time, at the first opportunity to address the court, defense counsel Stein moved for a mistrial. He moved for a mistrial on a multitude of reasons, but because of the impact of these natural occurrences, and he also moved for a mistrial because of the time frame that had passed and the external forces that the juries had been impacted with. He further asked the court to consider questioning each and every juror as to what impact this hurricane had had on their lives and whether they could concentrate on this trial and whether or not Mr. Pearson's due process rights were being violated. After argument on both sides, the court denied the defense's motion for a mistrial, and subsequent to that, the trial was resumed 2 days later when the jurors arrived back. It is important to note, Judge, that the court was unable to go forward on September 26th anyways. So our position, Judge, is that due to the fact that that the court failed to grant the mistrial, Mr. Pearson's rights were violated, and therefore the mistrial was inappropriately denied by the court.
So this is Judge Newsom. Can I just ask you?
Yes, sir.
Give us your best case. What's your best case to demonstrate that the district court, you know, typically we give district courts a lot of leeway in the management of their own cases and dockets. What's your best case to show us that the district court abused its discretion?
Well, Judge, on this specific incident, a careful search of all of the different cases in every different circuit only developed three separate cases on this issue. The most important, and I believe the one that the court should consider, is U.S. v. Hayes. It is a Ninth Circuit case out of the Ninth Circuit. And in that case, they specifically say that the court need not only consider, and I want to read from it exactly, the court says that one of the big issues in this is that the court says that this case had such a – in this case, Judge, I will tell you that it was a 48-day recess of the trial, but it's important what the court determined. The court determined that the probability that prejudice would result, that it had been deemed inherently lacking in due process, warranting relief, regardless of the defendant showing actual prejudice, and that is not only considering the length, the complexity of the trial, and the threat that the jurors would be exposed to improper outside influences during recess. So what this court is basically saying is that you cannot take the days as the only point to consider. I think you have to consider it based on the totality of the circumstances. It's not a finite number. It's not 21 days, 20 days. You need to consider it based on the time frame that has passed and the complexity of the trial. And I will tell the court that even though this was a short trial, prior to the motion for mistrial, the jury had heard from 19 witnesses and 148 exhibits had been presented. Subsequent to the mistrial, they heard from a agent, a quote-unquote summary witness, and another 50 exhibits had been introduced. So I think if the court considers the complexity, which it is defense's position that this case was definitely a complex case, and the outside influence of what was going on in this community as a whole, you need to consider that prejudice is something that can be implied, and therefore the due process of my client was violated. This is the only...
I think the difficulty for you, at least in my mind, is that your best case is an out-of-circuit decision that in all respects seems more extreme than this one. As you say, not to get too formalistic about it, but 48 days is against 22, and in that case, the trial had proceeded for 4 months, right, before the recess, and this one had proceeded for 4 days.
Right, Judge, but if you look at
the other... 2 minutes, counsel. 2 minutes, please.
Okay. Judge, what is going on, Judge, is because there's only three cases on this specific issue. So this is not a case where we have a lot of different cases that I can unfortunately rely upon. And I think one of the reasons for that is because usually courts, I mean, this is not the first case where an natural occurrence or something of extraordinary magnitude has happened during a trial. I think that courts consider the magnitude of the reason for the delay and grant mistrials. So the examples that you have is one that is 48 days, which is quite extreme, but you also have that court specifically saying that you need to look at the external forces. I don't think there's any higher external forces than that occurred during a hurricane and the impact on the community. Coupled with the fact that during jury selection, you spend a significant amount of time inquiring with your jury if there is anything that is of significant importance that it impacts the juror's ability to be impartial during the trial. Because this, beyond a doubt, is the most important day in Mr. Pearson's life, and his rights have to be protected. What happens is that this judge, unfortunately, even after asked by the defense, never goes back and inquires, listen, Mr. Smith, listen, Mr. Perez, how were you impacted? Were you displaced because of the hurricane? Do you even have electricity in your home? Have one of your family members been injured? None of that is really existing. So if you consider the impact that this natural disaster has had on the jury and the extent to which it was delayed, you have to consider that the client's due process rights are being violated because of that. And that's why I started my argument by telling you that this is a case of first impression, and it's a different sort of case because it makes the court consider this isn't a case where you have, unfortunately, a lawyer that gets sick or one specific person that gets sick. This is a case where prejudice is quite probable, if not possible, because of what is going on in the lives of everybody, not only the attorneys, the jurors, everybody that is involved. And that, I think, is an implied prejudice. An implied prejudice.
Thank you. You've reserved 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrea Hoffman, may it please the Court, Andrea Hoffman on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, I'm going to move directly to the issue of mistrial, and please feel free to interrupt me even during the initial 2 minutes if you have a specific question. As to the question of mistrial, in this case, the totality of the circumstances kind of argument that defense counsel was just making, the key issue to that would be balancing the factors that are in that particular trial, such as the time, and the potential prejudice to the defendant. The jurors in this case were told before they left the proceeding that the court would be, if there's any damage that will cause you to be unable to come to court, this was on September 5th, the day before the adjournment is implemented at page 170 on docket entry 202, the court, in speaking with the jurors and giving them an advance warning that they are paying attention to this impending hurricane, informs them that they are not excused, that they are still in the middle of the trial, that the court will be working with the jurors' schedules, and that if there is damage that will cause you not to be able to come to court, we will certainly assess that at the time. In this circumstance, when the discussions are occurring on September 5th, the court did, in fact, speak with the juries to see what their schedules were, because they had proceeded to trial in a time frame that they thought they would be completed roughly around the week that they adjourned. So being in trial at the end of the month of September is, all of you are more than well aware, the courts probably didn't inquire to what people's conflicts and difficulties and schedules were through the entirety of the month of September. But at the time that the court made the decision to proceed on the 27th instead of the 25th, they did in fact make that inquiry. So if jurors had been under some extensive impending difficulties, they had the opportunity, courtesy of the hurricane, they had the opportunity to present that information to the court, and none of the jurors told the court that they were unavailable or unable to proceed.
Ms. Hoffman, this is Beverly Martin. I think I'm right that the two jurors that had been out of the country were back in the jury box on the 27th. Is that right?
You are entirely correct, Your Honor, that all original 15 jurors that began this case were present for the remaining days up until the time of deliberation when they excused the three alternates. So the defendant received his original jury, completed his trial with his original jury, and received a verdict from his original jury. One of the issues that was briefed in this case is the question of invited error. And clearly it is the cardinal principle in appellate review that a party may not challenge as error a ruling that that party invited or induced to occur. And I don't mean to suggest that defense counsel in any form induced a hurricane, but defense counsel's statement on the first day that he asked for the adjournment was, in fact, considerably broader than defense counsel just alluded to. He didn't ask for an adjournment of that day. He asked for an adjournment of until whenever or wherever they can return, depending on whatever this occurs. He was openly telling the court, we need to stop until such time as this hurricane has passed and we can assess where we're all at. That started on the 6th. He had, in fact, begun the issue on the 5th. The reason they had the discussion I just summarized to the court on the 5th was because defense counsel had brought the issue to the court's attention on the 5th. At the conclusion of trial on September 5th, they had already been adjourned for the 7th and the 8th, which would have been Thursday and Friday of that given week. So they were coming back in for a Wednesday day of proceedings when defense counsel asked for an adjournment until whenever or whatever or whenever this entire thing, the hurricane, was completed. And defense counsel then is the one who informed the court that he would continue to have extremely limited availability on the 13th. When the court issued its order on the 15th, there was no objection from defense counsel to any abridgment of their client's rights in the delay until the 25th. And as the cases, particularly U.S. versus Love, a 2006 case from this court, states, the failure to object later to a ruling that has been a result of actions you have taken and during the course of the trial would be a classic example of an invited error. As to the question of prejudice here, as Judge Newsom alluded, the district court is ordinarily by far in the best position to assess the circumstances for whether a mistrial should or shouldn't be granted. And I will agree that ordinarily mistrial issues come up in the question of something that unexpected that happened in that trial, something that happened in the courtroom, somebody's particular unavailability. Those are the more typical cases of a mistrial request. In this circumstance, though, this judge is clearly one of the best positions to determine what has been the impact of a hurricane in its community. What is the restoration of power, for example, so a factor that the court took into consideration when it extended the time of the trial? And what are the circumstances that are facing the members of the community that are being asked to decide this very important issue. And based on an analysis of their personal experience with this hurricane and their personal situation of being present to watching how this trial played out, what kind of witnesses had come in, what kind of evidence had been presented, and what is left to go with the trial, this court found that there was not prejudice to the defendant's rights. And part of that is true because the court is able to give curative instructions to the key concerns that the defense raised about what could cause prejudice. For example, the question of the consideration of evidence. The court, in its jury instructions, not once, but three times on pages, docket entry 269 at pages 124, 126, and 128, this court three times told the jury that it must consider all of the evidence in the case, which means every one of the seven aggravated identity theft witnesses who testified before the hiatus courtesy of Hurricane Irma, and as well as all of the conglomerate of evidence that came in related to those counts and those frauds that were enacted in the course of this scheme. So the jury is presumed, absent clear evidence to the contrary, to have been able to have followed the court's instructions. They were also instructed at page 139 of that same docket entry. Excuse me, I'm going to cough, Your Honor. to consider each count separately and the evidence as to each count separately. And we have clear evidence that the jury did such because they, in fact, acquitted on two of the 32 counts that were ultimately presented to them for their jury deliberation. So in this case, we have the unique opportunity of learning that the jury could and did follow the court's instructions and that they could and did consider the individualized evidence presented across the span of this case. We know that the court brought them back in and polled them on the 25th of September as to whether they would be available and able to sit in trial on the 27th and the 29th, and potentially, as did end up happening, on October 2nd, as they were seeking to figure out how to proceed with this up to 15 jurors in a jury pool. None of the jurors expressed a problem with proceeding, be it a work in conflict, a personal conflict, such as catastrophic impact from this hurricane. So we are in an opportunity to know that the court, in fact, made the correct decision.
Ms. Hoffman, this is Beverly Martin. While I've got you, I was wondering if I could ask you a question about one of the other issues in the case.
Certainly, Your Honor.
I've read so many briefs for this week, I just want to make sure I've got this right. Can you walk me through exactly how the agents got Mr. Pearson's Drake password? And also, I was kind of interested in what information they got from the search of those files, to the extent that you have time to talk about it.
Your Honor, as to the Drake password, it is my understanding that the I apologize, I couldn't give you a cite to this, but I believe it has to be the Recessorania trial, that the agents contacted Drake, who has the equivalent of a backdoor password built into its system so that should something happen that you can get into the systems externally. And I believe they received that backdoor password from Drake, which was anticipated in the warrant, which gave the warrant authorized the use of any technological means to make the forensic examination that it was authorizing, including as to passwords. So I believe that they didn't, in fact, have to do a complicated code-breaking thing at the password system for the computer, Your Honor. Drake was able to provide an alternative backdoor entry to the computer system. And under Rule 41, where the analysis of having both a digital forensic analysis and that particular warrant anticipated that as well. So it was in accordance with the warrant that they contacted Drake.
Great. Thank you.
And in terms of, excuse me, Your Honor, I just realized I didn't answer the second question. I believe you're asking me what kind of materials they got from the computer, and as to...
Yes, the information that they found on under the password-protected files.
I can't answer that question with specificity to say to Your Honor that this sort of evidence was on password-protected portion of the computer, and this evidence was under the password-protected. There's nothing in the record that would delineate that for me. So at best, I'm going to be making an assumption to the court that the Drake materials that were testified to by, I believe, Ms. Vanderpool or Vanpool, something of that nature was her name, that those materials came under the password-protected search, but I cannot answer that specifically. Drake's system was the methodology by which the returns were forwarded. The bulk of the returns went in through the IRS witnesses. As I'm thinking about your question, Your Honor, I was just thinking if I looked at Ms. Vanderpool's trial transcript. So I apologize. I'm doing a momentary search for you while I look at her testimony because I may be able to answer that question with slightly more specificity than I just did.
Thank you.
Under Ms. Vanderpool, Your Honor, it does not appear from the trial transcript, and I'm only doing this based on the trial transcript, Your Honor. Court reporter does a itemization of when exhibits are offered and admitted. And under her testimony, there is a bulk exhibit that says Drake Software Records, which is Exhibit 73, and that appears to be largely the only exhibit that went in under her testimony, and I can't tell you from just the cold record. I can figure that out and inform you after the fact.
That's all right. This is helpful. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And also, I was wondering, in your view, how you distinguish the loss amount in Mr. Pearson's case from that in Ms. Anur's case, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly?
As close to pronunciation as I might get to, Your Honor. The distinction between the two is...
2 minutes. 2 minutes.
Certainly, Your Honor, I'll be as quick as I can to try and answer your question. First and foremost, Mr. Pearson made only a very generalized objection. He was, in fact, so he's waived the right to raise this argument at this before this court, I believe. But even if we moved on to considering it on a plain error consideration, because the district court very specifically said, can you give me more information? And then said, I can't make any more rulings regarding this because it is too generalized. There's not enough direction for the court to know what you're complaining about. Now, looking at it specifically up here, the distinction is, Your Honor, the court adopted all of the facts of the PSI after hearing the various contested hearings, and the only factual objection this defendant had made regarding the loss calculation was to the Rule 29 counts having been included in the calculation, which was an amount of money less than $11,000 or approximately $11,000, and it would not have altered any guideline loss calculation. The district court then, as to Mr. Pearson, went on to specifically find at, I believe it's at page 28 on the second day of the transcript, which is I think 271, that there had been a two-year scheme to defraud, that he had stolen money from the IRS, $5 million intended losses at least, and had obtained over $500,000, that he had used the identities of others to obtain it, that he had obtained multiple EFNs, the electronic filing corporate access code, to allow his scheme to expand throughout the course of its two-year period. She was focused upon the testimony of Irene Wilson, who explained that it was his idea. He had developed the gambling fraud concept and scheme and then directed all of the money laundering transactions that happened with related to the $114,000 refund for her son. She relied upon the statements of Anur, who said that he had at least four other tax preparer employees, that he was providing the false information on index cards to her to use to create the false returns, that there were more than 13 victims in this, that it had been a complex scheme using sophisticated means. She reiterated the four different types of frauds that had occurred, that he had filed numerous returns himself, and that his actions had could be found in each kind of fraud that he can stole the money.
Fired.
May I finish, Your Honor? I have just a couple of other factors to give you.
Yes.
That he had controlled the monies in the loss of the scheme, meaning he's the sole signatory on the account. He's the only person determined to ever remove the monies. And in monies that went to other places, he's the person who controlled and directed them. That he's the point of contact for both the IRS, the bank accounts, the landlords, Drake, EPS, and that he played a critical role. So using the analysis of the Anor case, he controlled who had access to his softwares and files. He had at least five people completing these false returns. He gave the information to Anor and others to how to complete them. He controlled the money and benefited from it. He had, to put it simply, his finger in all of the pies, in all types of the fraud.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. And as my time is up, I would ask that you affirm the district court in all respects.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Hi. I'd like to now respond to the government's position, unless the court has some questions to begin with. First and foremost, the government discussed potential prejudice, and I think that that is an important term because that is exactly what we have in this case. There's no way to actually identify or prove what this potential prejudice is, but it's important to clarify a couple of issues that the government came to light that we do not agree with. Number one, when defense counsel asked for the original case to be adjourned for that one day for the hurricane preparedness, this was joined in by the government, and the government specifically said that he was afraid of the jury not having time to be properly prepared, and he himself and his agents had to travel back to Palm Beach. The defense counsel did not request that this be a continuance eternally for a certain period of time because no one was really aware of what would happen with the hurricane. Would it pass within one day or would it pass within, 10 days or 20 days, which is what happened in this case. So as to invited error, I do not believe that the government can show that somehow the defense invited error in this case. The fact that they diligently advised the court of their specific situation back on the 13th, and then the court on its own motion on the 15th moved to continue the trial in no way shows that he invited error. The case law here as to invited error is completely different. The case cited by the government, U.S. v. Love, specifically deals with a case where a lawyer implied, discussed, encouraged the court to sentence a defendant to supervised release. And when the court did exactly that and sentenced him to supervised release and received that benefit, then later came back and said, oh, no, you couldn't sentence him to supervised release. And I think that would be analogized to the fact that if for some reason, if the court had granted our mistrial and then now we came back and argued, well, wait a minute, double jeopardy applies, that would be invited error because we requested the mistrial. In this case, Judge, unlike what the government said, the judge continued the trial by filing an order. It was not done in court. So therefore, the first opportunity that defense counsel had to object to that continuance was when they came back to court on the 25th, when he immediately, upon his first opportunity to address the court, asked for the mistrial. So it wasn't like he, for some reason, did not have an that he, his failure to ask for a for, to object on the 15th caused the was an error on his part. It would have been impossible because the courts were closed. As a matter of fact, the courts were closed several days after that. So I do not believe that as to the cases on invited error, the defense in any way invited error. The other things that the court addressed that I think that should be further discussed is that As to the other issue that this court was concerned as to whether or not they had a right when they executed the warrant to go into Drake and request a protected password, our position has been clear on that. There's no cases specifically on point on that issue, but our brief is clear that they exceeded the scope of the warrant by going to Drake requesting a protected password without a warrant, without an order from the judge, and then based on that getting confidential information that was not part and parcel of the original warrant. This is important because the testimony of the representative of Drake clearly made knowledge was one of the key factors the court relied upon. The government argued to imply that knowledge factor in this case, that because he had had so much business with Drake, because Drake had paid them so much money, because Drake is like a secondary company that collects the money from the IRS and then subsequently transfers it to either the defendant in this case or the person who's receiving the refund. Due to the extensive records that they received from Drake, which extended illegally, we believe, the four corners of the warrant, they were able to receive this damaging information. We believe the proper procedure would have been for them to go and get an additional warrant to get this information. I'm sorry, couldn't hear you. How much?
Time is expired.
Oh, okay. Judge, we would just in closing, just if one more moment, we would rely on our brief for all our other arguments, and we would ask the court to reverse the district court's decision on the motion for mistrial and grant Mr. Pearson a new trial.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay.
Have a wonderful day.